It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new survey measures how much religion and politics overlap and how much people want religious belief to be part of politics. We'll hear from a scholar of religion and maybe from you later in the show.
First, military action against the Islamic State movement continues with airstrikes last night in multiple locations in Syria. The strikes have gone on in Iraq since last month and in Syria starting last week.
Our next guest says the U.S. president is exceeding his constitutional authority with these military actions that he needs specific congressional approval to continue. Bruce Ackerman is with us. He's Sterling Professor of Law at Yale University. His recent piece, Obama's Betrayal of the Constitution, appeared recently in the New York Times. Bruce, welcome to the show.
A pleasure.
Well, the White House says the use of force authorization back in 2001 applies to the current military action against ISIS, in part because ISIS is a successor organization to Al-Qaeda. Why do you say that's not enough?
Well, the White House has not really made a serious legal argument yet. All they've done is make background comments and to reporters, the New York Times a couple of times. This kind of chatter, and that's all it is, and it shifts from time to time, is simply unworthy of the rule of law. If the White House actually believes that it's authorized by these resolutions passed 12 and 13 years ago in response to very different problems, it has to present serious legal arguments. And the way that it does so is by issuing an opinion. Either the White House counsel issues an opinion or the Office of Legal Counsel in the Justice Department. That's fundamental, and they haven't done it. That's just plain irresponsible.
Is there an argument that you think the White House could make that would convince you that they could keep doing this without specific new approval from Congress?
Well, this is just shadow boxing. I refuse to play this game. I'll tell you one thing that any serious legal opinion has to confront, and that is when George Bush responded much more responsibly than the Obama White House did by requesting an explicit authorization from Congress after September 11th. President Bush proposed a sweeping authorization for the use of force, which was not pinpointed at the groups and countries that were responsible for September 11th, but gave general authority to the president to preempt future threats, just as President Obama is doing today. Now, Congress, at this moment of high crisis, refused to grant President Bush a carte blanche. And they instead selected a much more limiting language expressly for the reason that the president should come back to Congress later on if he wants to extend the war to other terrorist groups. That's just what's going on now, and for a serious legal argument, the White House would have to prepare an opinion that confronts the legislative history that denies President Obama the very authority that he says that the 2001 resolution provides him. The key point, though, is that the War Powers Act of 1973 sets up a clear schedule. President Obama has 60 days to get congressional authorization, and then he has to end the bombing within 30 days thereafter if he fails. President Obama, consistent with the War Powers Act, informed both the Speaker and the President of the Senate on August 8th that he had commenced operations against the Islamic State. That meant the clock started running. President Obama obeyed the law of the War Powers Act. 60 days after August 8th is October 7th. 30 days more for the termination is November 6th, which is 2 days after the election. If there is no up and down vote by Congress by November 6th, on November 7th, members of the armed forces will go into court and say, look, we want to know whether we're fighting an illegal war. President Obama's silence plus Congress's irresponsible decision to go on a two-month recess for electioneering without either requesting President Obama to come forward with a serious legal argument rather than these comments to reporters, or, on the other hand, making an up or down vote under the War Powers Resolution, they were irresponsible. They said, oh, well, we have better things to do than make a clear decision on a crucial matter of war and peace. We have to run for re-election. Well, this is an invitation to the courts to take on this job. It would be if President Obama's silence plus Congress's going on vacation, on recess, who is going to decide this question when the members of the armed forces go into court?
In your op-ed, you describe this as a turning point. What do you see as the future of presidential, of executive military power if neither the president nor Congress takes this up and it doesn't get challenged in the courts?
Well, it will be challenged in the courts. I have no doubt. And this will, in the short run, undermine the war against ISIS. Is it a constitutional war? Is it not much better for the president and the Congress to resolve this issue? Rather than talking only about the future of irresponsibility, the thing to do is for Congress to be responsible now. And the War Powers Act gives a clear, it's a very well-drafted statute, really. It contemplates the possibility of Congress going on vacation, on recess. And it says that 30% of the Senate and 30% of the House, if they request a special session of the president of Congress, the Speaker and the President of the Senate shall so request it to the President of the United States. That is the responsible thing to do. I think that there are many people who are serious senators on both sides of the aisle who recognize that it'd be far, far better for Congress to confront this issue, both people like Rand Paul on the Republican side and people like Ron Wyden on the Democratic side. There are many people who recognize that this is simply irresponsible. If we get 30 senators and 30% of the House, then the Congress will get back in session for 3 or 4 days and debate this issue.
Do you see that as likely?
Congress did, before it left, a vote on the question of whether there should be a special appropriation for to train the Syrian responsible Syrian forces. More than 30% of the House voted against it, because they didn't think that they should get involved in Syria. And 22 senators voted against it. Would 30 senators go along? Well, it isn't so unrealistic. That's precisely why I'm raising it both here and in an op-ed that I wrote in Politico and various other places. This is precisely what the War Powers Act contemplates if Congress goes on recess at a crucial moment. If the president continues on his irresponsible course of not even presenting his legal arguments in a serious form to the American people, and Congress simply says, well, we might do something in the lame duck session after the election. This gesture of responsibility is become a little less credible, actually, because of the resignation of the Attorney General and the likelihood that the Obama administration will spend a good deal of time of the lame duck session trying to get a replacement approved. So the idea that Congress would also, during this period, make a considered judgment on the war against the Islamic State is less likely today than it was before. This precedent would be terrible. It is a decisive break with previous precedents under the War Powers Resolution, and would authorize a future president to simply assert without proof, without argument, that he can go to a war in some place in Africa because it is distantly related, some members are distantly related, perhaps, to the group that bombed the World Trade Center 20 years previously. This is just really a carte blanche. President Obama has been, of course, generally responsible and reluctant to engage in foreign wars, and it's a tragedy that he's creating this precedent for future presidents who might be more gun-happy than he is.
We'll leave it there. Bruce, thanks for joining us today.
Yes.
That was Bruce Ackerman. He's Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale University, making the case that President Obama needs congressional approval for military efforts in Iraq and Syria. A new report from the Pew Research Center says that Americans increasingly believe that the influence of religion on politics is waning. As that happens, the number of Americans who want religious leaders to speak out on politics and social issues is growing.
Wayne Thompson joins us to talk about the findings. He's an associate professor of sociology at Carthage College in Kenosha. Wayne, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for inviting me.
So I want to get to the results of this survey. What's changing when it comes to religion and politics in America?
Well, this is one of the Pew Forum studies. The Pew Forum regularly does surveys of the American population on religious issues. This particular survey was done in September and was done via telephone. What they saw is about a 10% jump among the religiously affiliated and Republicans in belief that churches should speak out about politics.
And how big a jump is that?
Well, it is a significant jump. 10% is 10% of the, you only get 100%. So it's a significant increase. But keep in mind that it is an increase that's concentrated among the part of the population that's most religiously active, that's most conservative, older. And so this is not a general jump among everybody, but it's enough so that overall, among all Americans, there is this 10% increase.
So when you see a shift like that among a certain group of people, do you look for what's driving the shift? Do we know why it's happening now?
Well, one factor that you can look at more long-range factors, and I thought about that in preparing for the interview, but one more proximate thing that's happening in the political sphere right now is that, at least with the presidency, the conservative Republican part of the population, they don't have the presidency right now. So that may be an immediate factor. More long-term, there is concern among the more traditional part of the population that religion is losing influence over a number of institutions, not only in government, but also in economics. Religion remains strong in family life, but let's face it, the most important institution in modern society is economics. So there's a perceived long-term influence of religion that it's perceived to be declining, at least.
Right. So it sounded as though most Americans believe the influence of religion on politics is waning. What sort of effect would that have, do you think?
Well, it could be a motivational factor for some segments of the population in terms of voting, certainly. About 32%, which is, keep in mind, is only a third, but about a third of Americans want the houses of worship, their houses of worship, to endorse candidates. Historically, evangelical Protestants have put out voter guides. Now, because they could lose their tax-exempt status, churches have to be careful to toe the line and not go too far. But historically, the evangelical Protestants do voter guides, which heavily favor Republican candidates. African-American Protestants do voter registration drives. So this could have an impact or reflect interest in the coming election here for November.
Now, I know you've thought about how this can be a touchy thing when you have religious figures getting involved in politics. It's not the norm for all organized religions to take political stances. Does this represent a sea change in wanting to see some of these officials more involved?
Well, as I said earlier, it might be some more proximate things going on, such as an election coming up, that can have some impact here. I do think long-term, there's been a tenuous and difficult and tense relationship between religion and politics. I think back about when Dwight Eisenhower was president, he said it didn't matter so much where you pray, but that you pray. So we do expect our political leaders to be to express a certain amount of piety. It gets a lot trickier, though, when religious leaders speak out because of tax-exempt status, separation of church and state, and the Catholic bishops, for instance, found in the 1970s and 80s that the things they wanted to speak out on, which at that time were nuclear weapons and preferential option for the poor, weren't always the issues that the people in the pews wanted. So you have this problem of political leaders expected to be religious. But religious leaders, when they speak out on politics, it's quite a minefield for them.
Well, would you say that, you know, essentially what this amounts to is a growing divide between religious America and non-religious America?
Well, that's what the study concluded, and I would see that as well, that the religiously unaffiliated and some religious folks who are religious, but here I would restrict to mainline Protestants to some extent, they're pretty split. Jews tend to be much more liberal in their social and political outlook. Those with no religious preference tend to be more religious in their outlook, although not everybody who's not religiously affiliated. So indeed, it is tricky. It's difficult to make general statements like that. But in general, if I was a betting person, I would say that the religiously affiliated are, you know, this does reflect their polarization from those who are not religious and their disdain for such people.
Well, it's interesting because this comes at a time when politics in America are incredibly polarized. You know, Congress has an extremely low approval rating. There's a lot of cynicism about, I think, institutions in general. Do you see that as being part of what's happening here?
Well, absolutely. I took a look at some general social survey results, too, another survey that's regularly conducted on Americans, and you can see a very large decline in the confidence in organized religion and in all large institutions. We've seen this decline since the Watergate era of the mid-1970s. It's finally caught up to religion. In 1973, 36% of Americans had a great deal of confidence in organized religion. It is 25% by 2006. So there's definitely a decline in people trusting organized religion. Ironic that at the same time they're asking religious leaders to speak out more.
Well, would you say that people still trust or would still want their politicians to have some sort of praying habit or religious habit?
Oh, yes. There's a clear preference here. And the history of the United States is illustrative in this regard. You think about who is considered have been great presidents. They all had some kind of religious mooring or prophetic voice that they could speak to the American public. Certainly, I would see that for Lincoln as a great example. President Lincoln, he often couched his political views in religious language. And I think that we still expect our leaders to do that.
We're talking with Wayne Thompson right now about a new poll by the Pew Research Center suggesting an increasing number of Americans think religious influence in America is waning, and they are wanting more religious figures to have a greater voice in politics and social issues.
And we want to hear from you. Do you see religion in America waning in political influence? If so, what do you make of that shift? Would you like to see religious figures more involved in politics? And does your religion influence how you vote, how you get active in politics? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking with Wayne Thompson right now about a new poll by the Pew Research Center gauging the overlap of politics and religion, how people feel about that overlap here in America.
And we want to hear from you. Do you want to see religion in the United States waning in influence, or do you want more religion in politics? What do you make of the shift that we're talking about in that survey? And does your faith influence the way you vote, the way you participate in politics? And what would you like to see from religious leaders? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go now to the phones. We've got Darren joining us first in Viroqua. Hi, Darren.
Well, certainly the influence of religion has waned, deservedly so, because, and I speak as an ex-Catholic, the Catholic Church has no moral authority whatsoever because they continue to look the other way when their priests and bishops are involved in, whether it's pedophile scandals or homosexual scandals. Then you have the evangelical TV preacher scandal. But I do speak as a born-again Christian and as an ex-gay person, and I feel that those in the evangelical fold, pastors need to speak out more on moral issues. You call them political issues. I call them moral issues, and there's a wide variety of moral issues. But they should never tell us who to vote for. There should never be a voter guide that specifically says you need to vote Republican.
All right. Thank you so much, Darren, for sharing your thoughts there. And social issues are tied up in all of this. It's political and social issues that Americans would like to see religious figures more outspoken on. But what about Darren's point there about Catholicism and the struggles there, some of the scandals driving these results?
Yeah, the internal polling that the Catholic Church does for the United States, at least, I'm surprised to see it, but has shown relatively minimal influence. It has not had a really long-term impact yet at this point. I think what's happened, though, with the new Pope speaking out on trying to shift the topics to poverty, you know, preferential option for the poor is the language that they use, those kinds of issues, it shifts away from the sexuality issues. And I think traditionalist Catholics in North America are not really pleased with that. They would like to see a continuation of this focus on sexuality issues. And so the religious leaders themselves make choices about what they want to emphasize.
Is it more than Catholicism, or could one religion be responsible for a lot of these numbers, at least the waning part of it?
Well, I think you'd really do need to separate. There are different narrative bubbles that people live in for religious folks, and evangelical Protestants, traditionalist Catholics, they do tend to be focused more on the private, moral, sexual issues are of more importance to them. For mainline Protestants, for Jews, for those who are not religiously affiliated at all, their concerns are more about social inequality, social justice, racial justice. So these narrative bubbles dictate what the topics are going to be.
Great. Well, let's go back to the phones. Now, Jared is again with us here from Green Bay. Hi, Jared.
Personally, I find religion and politics to be irritating and obstructive. And honestly, I'd like to see the government be a little bit more stricter about the tax-exempt status. I don't know, is that the IRS that does that? Because I think that's a decent question. And honestly, I consider the reduction of religion in politics in America to be nothing but a good thing. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Jared. And Jared is happy to see this trend here of waning religious influence in America. At least that's how Polans perceive it. What do you think about what he said about the tax-exempt status? Is that something that you see trending as well?
Sure. That's a great question. The government, no matter who's in power, is not been very forceful in cracking down on the tax-exempt status of churches that do get involved in politics. It's only a handful of churches that really are at risk in any given year. And so, indeed, churches do speak out, and prominently in recent years, evangelical Protestants talking about what I call the pelvic issues. And so some of the other issues that we've seen, you know, sometimes more, it's the liberal agenda that's being pushed. In the civil rights era, during the Vietnam War protests, religious leaders more from mainline Protestants and the liberal side of things were more forcefully involved. So there, you know, this does waver over time, but the tax exempt crackdown, I would not be looking for that anytime soon. The government's reluctant to be seen as kind of bullying religious leaders.
Okay, thanks, Jared. And let's go next to John in Elgin, Illinois. Hi, John.
Hi. Yeah, I worked in the news business for years for ABC News, and I traveled around the country quite a bit, and this was during the Reagan years. And I saw a lot of organizations in Southern Baptist areas where people were organizing, actively organizing, with the intention of influencing politics. And we have in our Constitution a separation of church and state. For one religion or any religion, fine to have a religion. And by the way, I do believe in taxing churches, too. I don't see any reason why not. My family's paid plenty in taxes. But it's propaganda. We get enough propaganda from our own government and other governments. It's getting worse, where people in this country are feeling more powerless. And that's why you find numbers dwindling in interest and trust in these big institutions.
Okay, well, thanks a lot for your thoughts, John. Appreciate your call there. And what do you say to that, Wayne?
Well, I think you have to pinpoint just how this separation of church and state works out in our country. As an operative reality, there is a connection between religion and politics. Local pastors are not where that often is going to be focused, because local pastors have to make a living. People can vote with their feet. You may have, in the mainline Protestants, you often have blue state pastors, red state congregations. The red state congregations and pastors, the Southern Baptists, for instance, the largest Protestant organization in America, they have blue state people sitting in the pews, too. So local pastors aren't really where the political, you know, where people are speaking out from religion. It's often specialty organizations, denominations, general assemblies, national organizations speaking out. At the local level, which is where most people experience religion, pastors are nervous. They look out from the curtain and wonder who's going to walk out if they say something that's offensive.
I want to ask you about another phenomenon that we've seen in the polls recently, and that is the rise of the nuns. They're called the group that's religiously unaffiliated. They may categorize themselves as spiritual, but I wonder where you think they would fall when it comes to questions like these.
Well, in the Pew Forum survey, as well as general social surveys and many other surveys, the religiously unaffiliated, those who have no religious preference, tend to be much more liberal on social issues. It's not always true. There is a segment of the unaffiliated who are more conservative. But on most of the sexuality issues, for instance, those who are religiously unaffiliated are more liberal. So, of course, they're going to be reticent to support religious leaders speaking out.
Now, I know you said just a moment ago that you thought religious figures might be nervous about this, worried about what they're going to say, that they might alienate certain sections of their congregations. But do you think that they will respond to this kind of pressure and this kind of preference for people to want to see more opinions out there, more political and social issue opinions, and that they'll respond by becoming more politicized?
Well, I think what's going to happen, you know, looking into the future, we don't have a crystal ball, but looking into current trends, what's happening is that conservatives are splitting off from mainline Protestant denominations into their own separate denominations, speaking to their faithful. And I think when you have red state pastors and red state congregations, or blue state pastors and blue state congregations, which is less common, that they will speak out to those audiences, speaking more in the public sphere. I'm not sure that we would look for that, because polarization means you're speaking more to those within your own bubble.
So you see that trend of polarization in America continuing. Now we're not seeing it not just in politics, but in religion.
Yes, indeed, and institutionally, it's true. The homosexuality issue has kind of exploded in the religious scene and divided traditionalists and those who are more accommodated to social change, let's say, splitting into separate denominations. We're seeing that in all the mainline churches. With the evangelical Protestants, even there are some blue state people, let's say more moderates, that are looking to split off from the Southern Baptists. They're starting pension boards, and that's indicative of a general polarization between conservatives and liberals across all of our society.
Wayne, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
We've been speaking with Wayne Thompson, Associate Professor of Sociology at Carthage College in Kenosha. In October, Wisconsin Public Television is going to release a new round of Wisconsin Life. We've got a lot of fresh episodes coming up, and here to give us a preview of some of these episodes is Joe Waldinger. He's a producer for Wisconsin Public Television. Joel, welcome back.
Thank you.
And for our first episode, it's going to air Monday, October 6th. We've got a story centering around bald eagles. Tell us about that one.
Yeah, that's right. I spent a day with Mike Meyer, who works for the Department of Natural Resources. He spent the past 25 years doing bald eagle research in Wisconsin, and he's come across hundreds of bald eagles that he's helped ban for his research purposes.
So these aren't injured eagles. These are a part of his project to see how the eagles are doing as a species.
Yeah, absolutely. They want to monitor the population of Wisconsin. Wisconsin's eagle population, which continues to grow. They're also tracking migration and nesting habits of these eagles, and they also keep mortality records, how eagles are dying in Wisconsin, that type of thing. Main part of his research is actually to check contaminants, PCB and pesticide levels from 25 years ago to is the environment improving for bald eagles in Wisconsin, and his research is finding it. Yes, indeed it is.
All right, we've got a clip of that one. Let's take a listen.
It's no easy feat to reach an eagle's nest in white pines that can grow 100 feet straight up in what's described as a super canopy tree.
When they build the nest, they don't make it convenient for the climber.
Each tree is a different high wire act.
He's got to find a way around the edge of the nest but still stay attached to the tree.
Getting around a nest that can be 4 to 5 feet in diameter can present a unique and sometimes dangerous encounter.
Wow, sounds fascinating. So were you there on the ground while this guy's climbing up in the trees?
We were. We went with him on three separate nests, and the day that we went, it happened to be extremely windy. So you can imagine what that was like to try to climb to the top of this tree 75 feet to 100 feet in the air with winds gusting, and then at the same time try to maneuver around the nest and then get the baby eaglets and lower them to the ground.
Did you go up to get sound?
We didn't. We mounted a camera on his helmet.
There you
and
go.
We got spectacular video because of the wind gusts. These eagles are actually full grown at 6 to 8 weeks of age and ready to fly. So with these wind gusts, if they open their wings at any moment, the gust could literally blow the baby eagles out of the nest. And in this case, there were two eagles in one nest, and the camera captures them clinging literally to the side of the nest with their wings open. And it's tense. You think at any moment one of these eagles could go, and the researchers on the ground were actually quite concerned.
Oh. Well, did you get close yourself in the lab, maybe not up in the tree, but at another time?
Yeah, the lab is actually on the ground below the tree. They lower the eagles down in a knapsack, basically, and take them out, take blood samples, feather samples, and then they band them for their research. And then they raise them back up to the climber in the tree, who takes them out of the bag and places them back in the nest. Mother eagle, by the way, is soaring overhead the entire time, but you know, most people would think that aggressive, the eagle would dive bomb into the nest or something with the researcher up there, but it doesn't happen. She actually stays a distance away and maybe makes some calls and things like that, but never actually attempts to get in the nest when the climber's up there.
That's a relief. They seem to have very sharp beaks and talons.
But they do. It's a dangerous job.
Sounds fascinating being up there so high and getting the bird's eye view of the eagle. Sorry, you have to forgive me. I had to say it. Let's go into another piece here. You're also featuring a piece on dresses that were designed in World War II, and there's a lot of backstory to this, a lot of history, and it's a sad one, but it's also kind of beautiful.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite stories, actually. Paul and Hetty Stranad were Jews trapped in Czechoslovakia after the Germans had occupied their homeland. They had this ingenious idea. Hetty was a dress designer, and so she designed 8 dresses and sent the dress designs to relatives in Milwaukee who had some connections. And the hope was that she could get these dresses made and then emigrate to the United States. It's a story that the Jewish Museum Milwaukee has tried to keep alive over the years.
And we've got a clip from this episode. Here it is.
It touched my heart then, and I knew that it would be important.
It was a letter.
In 1997, we had a Jewish archives, and Bert Sternad came in, and he said, I have these pictures from my father. I opened up the packet, and here were these 8 dress designs. The story, of course, is they were seeking help in leaving Prague because the Germans had already entered the country.
The 8 dress designs, created by Paul's wife, Hedy Sternad, could be their ticket out. The Stranads had Jewish relatives in Czechoslovakia that owned a clothing store, just like their Jewish relatives in Milwaukee.
I have sent you some of the dress designs my wife made, and I hope the dress manufacturers you mentioned in your letter will like them.
If an American dressmaker picked up the designs, it could provide financial stability for the Stranads, helping them secure immigration papers.
I don't know if you want to give away the whole thread of that, because there is a bit of a mystery involved in this one. But the dresses, they did get made.
Yeah.
Years and years later, but they got made.
They did. Unfortunately, the Stranads did not make it out of Czechoslovakia. They ended up being sent to the Warsaw Ghetto and were killed at the hands of the Nazis. About 15 years ago, these dress designs came to the Jewish Museum Milwaukee, which when it opened became the central focus of their Holocaust exhibit. About a year or so ago, someone said, wouldn't it be great if we fulfill Hedy's wishes and we make these dresses? So over the course of the past year, working with Milwaukee Repertory Costume Shop, these theater designers actually produced the dresses that Hedy had designed, and they're now on display at the Jewish Museum Milwaukee as part of an exhibit called Stitching History from the Holocaust.
What do they look like?
They're fabulous, actually. They're very classic. You know, I asked one of the founders of the Jewish Museum Milwaukee, how would you describe these dresses? And she said they're classic and they're dresses that every woman would want in her closet.
And when does that one air? For people who want to catch that particular one.
Yeah, that one's going to air on Monday, October 13th at 8 p.m. on Wisconsin Life on Wisconsin Public Television.
Gotcha. And we'll move on to another one now. This is a story about an amphicar. Am I saying that right? What is it?
Yeah, amphibious car. Amphicar for short.
Okay.
You know, it's part car, part boat. 50-50 surf and turf, as we say. In other words, it's a car you can take right up to the boat launch and drive it into the water. It's based on a World War II German military design.
Is this like the things that you see in the Dells, the ducks? Is it something like that?
It's similar, but it's much smaller than that. It's basically seats 4 people. It was designed in the 60s. It's a small car. On top, it looks like a convertible, which it is. It's a convertible top. Underneath, you have the 4 wheels like a car, but you also have 2 propellers. And so that allows it to navigate in the water.
Did you get to ride in this thing?
We did ride in it. Yeah, we did. Up in Sturgeon Bay, Russ Seeler is... found one of these amphicars on a farm field and bought it. First saw it as a 16-year-old kid, bought it, tore it completely apart, and restored it. And now you can see him driving around the Sturgeon Bay Ship Canal in it.
All right, here's a little bit of that one.
Every time I go in, you just get the heebie-jeebies a little bit. You wonder, you know, if everything's going to be okay. And we're pretty cocky at first. And I like to power into the wakes and make a big splash. Well, the ones were rolled up right over the hood and right over the top of the windshield, and it was like 2 5-gallon pails of smelly bay water in our laps, and it's all vinyl seats and rubber floor mat, and it just trickles down the bilge. Almost every time when we pull out, there's a few people that ask me, did you just come out of the water? You know, they don't know what to say, but it's hilarious.
Okay, so you said it's a... quite an experience being in that car. Is it, I don't know, is it cool? Would you want to do it again?
It is very neat to do. It's a little bit wobbly. I mean, I rode along because you need to balance the car with just the driver in, like in a boat leaning to one side, the passenger balances it. You know, on the highway, it's a little rickety. It's a little shaky, as he would admit to. You know, it's not really built for speed. It's built for the cool factor.
I see. So maybe not a lot with the suspension, because maybe you don't want that in the water.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. Wow. Well, we're going to stick with our water theme here. Now, this is a story about Sturgeon Bay, but we're going to move into the caves now. Tell us about the caves in Sturgeon Bay.
Yeah, the caves in Sturgeon Bay are really unique in Door County in and of themselves. They're wild in the sense that you never know what you're going to find when you go into the caves, bears or raccoons or snakes or other animals, and wild in the sense that they're millions of years old. And in many parts of these caves, they're still in their natural setting that they were millions of years ago.
Now, it's interesting. I know about the Lake Superior caves, but I guess I haven't heard as much about Lake Michigan caves. Are they similar in the sorts of things you'll find, or are they their own thing?
Yeah, there are the caves right along the shoreline, but then there are also caves that are inland. In fact, there's one in downtown Sturgeon Bay that's in the basement of a senior living center.
Wow.
It was discovered when they dug the basement in 1972. There's no natural entrance to this cave. It was created by an earthquake millions of years ago, and the only entrance is through the basement of the senior living center.
Do the seniors go down there? Do they use it? Or is it more just a curiosity in a while?
It's more for researchers. Yeah. I mean, it takes a little maneuvering to climb through the entrance to the cave to get actually back into an area where you can stand up.
Okay, well, let's listen to a little from that episode.
Gary has spent a lifetime exploring caverns around the world and even discovered the Diamond Room of Paradise Pit Cave in southern Door County.
I started back in 1961. It was April 14th. I happened to see a Mammoth Cave in Kentucky and took the historic tour, and I've been hooked for over half a century now.
Hooked, despite a few close calls.
Right here in Door County was probably the worst one I had. We're at a tight area. I had to keep my hands to my side, and it was wiggling forward. And all of a sudden, as I looked up, here's a live skunk. And let me tell you, if you want to learn how to reverse cave in a hurry, you'll learn real fast.
I don't know. That doesn't sound good. A live skunk in a tiny cave. Did that end well?
It did end okay. Gary got out without any problems. But, you know, he thrives on that kind of thing. You know, it's whatever his headlamp, you know, shines on that lures him deeper into the cave.
Fantastic. Now, did you go down to the cave as well?
We went into the cave in the basement of the Dorchester Cave, which it sounds, we were told, oh, you got to crawl for about 10 or 20 feet. Well, what he didn't tell us is it was more like maneuvering like a snake over these huge boulders to get in, scraping along, you know, on the bottom to get to an area where you could actually stand
up. Well, I'm glad it wasn't me. Glad it was you and Gary.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that'll be fun to watch. Thank you so much for coming on and telling us about the next season.
Thank you very much for having me.
We've been speaking with Joe Waldinger, producer for Wisconsin Public Television. He was with us to give a preview of what's coming up on the Wisconsin Life TV series this month. New episodes are starting October 6th and air Monday nights at 8 o'clock p.m.